From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour for you, the numbers lady, Glynis McCants, our guest, as she looks at some past and future predictions. Glynis is always a fascinating person to have on the program. There are some things in life that are very difficult to say. This is one of them. I received a phone call from our network just a few hours ago informing me that Ramona Bell, Art's beloved wife, has passed away. She died sometime today, and that's all we really know at this time. Our deepest condolences go out to Art and his family for this tragic loss. I'm sure Art would want us to carry on tonight with this program, so we shall do that. And that's all we really know. Coast guest Douglas Hagman, as I reported yesterday, collapsed while he was testifying in court. Douglas, of course, is the person we turn to for terrorist activity. He runs the website HomelandSecurityUS.com. We have found out today that what happened to Douglas is he had a minor heart attack. Doctors have been contemplating all day what to do about that situation, and as soon as we find out, we'll pass that on to you. Douglas has been a very important contributor to Coast. With medical experts saying that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has had little chance of returning to politics following his devastating stroke Wednesday night, many are questioning the future of not only internal Israeli politics, but out of the entire Middle East peace process. Some observers are wondering if there is another robust commanding leader within the newly formed Kadima Party, that's called the Forward Party, who can effectively steer the organization and who can ensure that progress continues in reconciling differences between Palestinians and Israelis after years of bloodshed. Many Israelis felt Sharon was best positioned to draw Israel's final borders and a settlement with the Palestinians. In September, he orchestrated Israel's exit from the Gaza Strip, becoming the first Israeli leader to turn over the land to the Palestinians for their future state. And Prime Minister Sharon's suffering of this massive stroke in the back of an ambulance while on an hour-long trip to a Jerusalem hospital has raised a host of questions about his treatment. Why wasn't he flown to the hospital or at least driven to one closer? Did doctors take an unnecessary risk by treating him with blood thinners after he had a mild stroke 2 weeks ago? Did they wait too long to schedule a heart procedure designed to prevent another stroke? And perhaps most importantly, could political pressures have colored his treatment? In a moment, we'll be talking with a very special guest, Dr. John Abramson, about this treatment and what it all means. Earlier today, the Reverend Pat Robertson says Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's massive stroke could be God's punishment for giving up Israeli territory. The founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network told viewers of the 700 Club that Sharon violated God's land, even though the Bible says doing so invites God's enmity. Robertson added, "I would say woe to any Prime Minister of Israel who takes a similar course." He noted that former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. Robertson said, "God's message is, this land belongs to me. You'd better leave it alone." Meanwhile, in Iraq, suicide bombers have killed at least 120 people in two central Iraqi cities in the deadliest attacks since elections last month. The first blast was near a major shrine in Karbala, killing at least 60 people and injuring 100 more. Soon afterwards, a blast at a police recruiting center in Ramadi killed about 60 people, injuring some 60 others. A defiant Iran did not turn up for a promised meeting Thursday with the head of the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency to discuss the country's suspected nuclear program. A high-ranking Iranian delegation was supposed to meet with International Atomic Energy Agency head Mohammad El-Baradei to provide him with details of its plans to move closer to uranium enrichment, which is a process which can produce both fuel for nuclear energy or nuclear weapons. The meeting simply never took place. Iran has told the IAEA that it planned to resume nuclear fuel research after a 2.5-year hiatus, posing a fresh challenge to Western nations concerned that Tehran is trying to build an atomic weapon. Some of the 12 coal miners who died following an explosion left notes behind assuring family members that their final hours trapped underground were not spent in agony. The notes said that they weren't suffering, that they simply were just going to sleep, said Peggy Cohen, who had been called to a makeshift morgue at a school to identify the body of her father, 59-year-old mining machine operator Fred Ware Jr. Cohen said a note was not left with Ware's body, but that she planned to retrieve his personal belongings later to see if he had left one in his lunchbox. She said that the medical examiner told her notes left with several of the bodies all carried a similar message: your dad did not suffer. Ware was among a dozen miners who were found after 41 hours inside the mine. They were found at the deepest point of the Sago mine, about 2.5 miles from the entrance in West Virginia. Strange weather we're having. The long, strange life of Zeta continued as it again strengthened into a tropical storm and could break the record for the storm that lasted the longest into January since record-keeping began in 1851. Zeta, which poses no threat to land, is the last and 27th named storm in a very record-breaking 2005 Atlantic hurricane season. It is the only second Atlantic storm in recorded history to survive into January, joining Hurricane Alice in 1955. After Zeta dissipates, forecasters will review records to determine whether it or Alice lasted longest into January. Now, Sylvia Brown, who's taking some heat across the country for her apparent wrong prediction on this program about the coal miners, well, said this on the program about traveling on trains. I want you to hear it.
Everything that you foresee in 2006, I haven't heard you say anything about terrorism or terrorist attack. How come?
The only thing that I'm concerned about, and I've said this now, is and I kept saying about trains, and look at the trains we've had go up, and not so much just the terrorists, but I just tell people, please stay off of trains, not only because of the terrorists, but because of tracks, or something's wrong with the tracks. Every time you turn around, and of course, they don't make headlines like airplanes, but we've had, I don't know how many hundreds of train wrecks, and I keep saying to people, stay off the damn train.
Well, in fairness then to Sylvia, in Virginia, a commuter train derailed during Thursday's morning's rush hour, injuring at least 4 people, tying up rail travel. The Virginia Railway Express was carrying 400 passengers toward Washington when the engine and the last 3 cars went off the tracks just north of Quantico. The cause was not immediately known. In a moment, our guest, John Abramson, we're going to talk with him about how they treated Ariel Sharon and to see if they contributed to some of the devastating illness that he has now suffered, the massive stroke. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John Abramson, doctor, has worked as a family doctor in Appalachia and in Hamilton, Massachusetts, and has served as chairman of the Department of Family Practice at Lahey Clinic. He has written a book called Overdosed America, Broken Promises of American Medicine. He was our guest just a few weeks ago on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to talk with him about the treatment of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to see if that contributed to his massive stroke. First of all, John, thank you for joining us at this short notice. I appreciate it.
George, it's a pleasure to be with you.
This treatment with Sharon, there are a lot of questions that I want to ask you about, but this blood thinning that they put him on, could that have contributed to this massive stroke that he had?
Almost certainly it did, George. The advantage of the blood thinner is that it prevents the kind of clots from forming that caused Prime Minister Sharon's first stroke. But the risk is that it thins the blood so much that bleeding can occur. And in the case of the second stroke, bleeding did occur into Sharon's brain, causing what's called a hemorrhagic stroke or a bleeding stroke, very much different than the first stroke he had.
We were reporting, John, well over a week ago about the initial small stroke that he had, suffered that on December 18th. Why did they wait so long to decide when to operate on him? They were going to go in and repair a part of his heart that they said was congenital, had it since he was born. Why did they wait so long?
Well, that's a good question. I think we need to explore that. And my hunch is that they waited, that it was Prime Minister Sharon's decision, probably a decision that he made about what would be best for him politically. He was trying to get the Kadima party going. In fact, at the time he had the stroke, he was naming his prospective cabinet members. So I think that Prime Minister Sharon had made this major change in the course of his life and Israel and really world history to reach out to try to make peace. And I think that that was his primary commitment. He may have delayed the procedure and increased the time that he was at risk because he was on those blood thinners.
If he wasn't on the blood thinners, would he still be, I guess, in the kind of condition he was prior to this massive stroke?
Almost certainly he would, George. The blood thinners in this case did much more harm than good. But it's hard to fault the doctors for doing that. Because had he not been put on the blood thinners, and if he had another thrombotic stroke or stroke from a blood clot because there was too much clotting, then the doctors would have been faulted because they didn't thin his blood. So this is a situation where there's not a perfect decision, and you have to weigh the risks of treating or not treating with the blood thinner.
What if they had just given him simple aspirin, John? Would that have worked for him?
Well, in retrospect, I wish they would have, and that might have been a better cost-benefit ratio to have gone with than a more potent blood thinner. But you just don't know, George. I think that he had already had a small stroke. He had a hole in his heart, and we ought to talk about how that contributes to a stroke. But there was a clear and present danger from the kind of very small stroke he had on the 18th, from which he recovered completely. And I think his doctors, were looking at that clear and present danger rather than the theoretical possibility of bleeding with the blood thinner.
In this particular case, he is now on what they call a 72-hour induced coma. I have a friend of mine who is dead now. He was a former county executive of St. Louis County. His name is Buzz Westfold. He died under something very similar. They induced him. They gave him a coma to work on some virus that he had, and they couldn't take him out of it, John. They couldn't pull him out of the coma. He died.
Right.
That's a danger. Sir,
yep, I'm sorry.
That's a danger, isn't it?
It's certainly a danger. I mean, many deaths occur because of medical care. In fact, one of our leading scholars about primary care medicine, Barbara Starfield, is a professor at Johns Hopkins. She calculates that medical care itself is the third most frequent cause of death in the United States after heart attacks and cancer. So there's no question that medical care is risky, and no question that the medical care that Prime Minister Sharon is now getting is risky. I think all the experts agree that it's a desperate situation, and that the nine-hour operation, and it really looks like he had two operations, are desperate measures to try and save his life, that he is in critical condition right now.
He's on a respirator. Of course, we don't know his true condition, and you, of course, you're not there as his doctor, but if they took him off the respirator, do you think he'd pass away?
Unclear right now. But what is clear is that he is in grave condition and a complete recovery is virtually impossible. The statistics show that about half of the people who have surgery to stop a stroke caused by bleeding, half of the people are dead in 30 days. And we know that when a person has bleeding into his brain, that an area about an inch or an inch and a half around that bleeding gets quite damaged. So it's not just that he had the bleed, it's the area around it, and then the neurosurgeons going in to find the bleeding spot have to go through healthy brain tissue to get to the bleeder and tie it off, stop the bleeding. So there's been a lot of damage in Prime Minister Sharon's brain, and it's unlikely that he's going to recover to a meaningful state of life.
So I'm sure the government of Israel now must contemplate what they are going to do. I guess there's supposed to be elections March 28th. They've got this window here with the person who's going to be in charge now, his deputy.
Right.
But you truly believe then that Sharon will not go back into power?
I don't think there's any way. That would be a true miracle. That would make me a great believer, George. I think, unfortunately, that his productive life is over, and I think it's really a tragedy. We have a man who was a warhorse and a grisly leader, some say courageous, some say overly militant, who really, at this point in his life, really saw peace and really saw a way to move his country towards coexistence with their enemies of many decades. And it breaks my heart that at this point in his life, he gets stricken when he was just about to be able to bring the Israeli people together into this new state of accommodation and peace.
Well, there's no doubt about that. He was, in his earlier days, very militant, very aggressive, somehow seemed to change, tempered more dramatically than any person I've seen in this particular situation, John. I mean, he was accused of all things in a Palestinian camp of years ago that he may have been very responsible for. Something changed him. Something turned him into someone who was truly trying to find peace. And, I think he had seen the light.
I think so. You know, I think that he was an example. I can't get inside his head, but I think that he was an example of what we call healthy aging. As people age and develop a bigger wisdom, a grander vision, sort of get in touch with the whole spirit, not just with the younger man's partisan vision of spirit. And you had a sense that he was developing for himself a grander spirit, a grander vision of how the people in the Middle East could live, and that he personally was willing to take some risk and make some sacrifice to achieve that stability that's been just so elusive in the Middle East. It's just such a tragedy, George, that he gets cut down now, that he gets taken away from us now, that he could make this bridge that has been so lacking in that part of the world.
Had you been his doctor on December 18th, what would you have done?
Good question. I certainly would have given him an anticoagulant of some sort. Let me tell you, George, I was involved defending a family doctor who had a patient who had a hole in his heart, a situation similar to this. The hole wasn't recognized until there was a devastating stroke. And the doctor was being sued because he didn't use an anticoagulant. Fortunately, the suit was settled and there were no charges against the doc that I was defending. But the point that I'm making is that had the doctors not used an anticoagulant, they would have, and something gone wrong, they would have been more vulnerable to criticism than they are now for having used the anticoagulant.
I think you're right, John. Now, will doctors around this country, perhaps this world, take a different look, a different approach into what they do and do not do in terms of prescribing these anticoagulants?
Well, that's a good question, and that really starts to beg the question that I address in Overdosed America. We use way too many medicines, and the reason why we do it is because most of the information that we doctors get, the best information that's published in our best journals, most of that information comes from the drug companies themselves. And they have a great interest in telling us to use their drugs and in showing us data that makes their drugs look like they're better. And in fact, we've had a series of scandals recently where the drug companies have hidden data that shows the risks of their drugs. So I hope that one of the useful outcomes is to leave doctors with a slight bit more humility about the dangers of these powerful medicines that we're using.
How appropriate, John, for you, the author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promises of American Medicine, as we talk about this condition and the situation with Ariel Sharon.
Absolutely. And yet, I think it's so important, George, not to be overly critical of these docs. I mean, generally, I'm in the position of saying there was too much medicine given. The doctors, and typically that the doctors had bad information because it came from the drug companies. On this one, you know, a lot of medicine has a lot of life. You have to make a decision, and you have to make the decision that you can live with if things go wrong. And I think in this case, I think the docs did the right thing.
John, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to take some questions specifically for you about medical treatment. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest this hour, Dr. John Abramson. We'll be back with John in your phone calls as we talk about Overdosed America on Coast to Coast AM. Look, I'm getting a lot of emails and fast blasts from a lot of you about the passing of Ramona Bell, Art's wife, and I think it's very appropriate to lead you to Whitley Strieber's website. Whitley, of course, a dear friend of both Art and Ramona's, and Whitley has a little bit more information for you, and it would be more appropriate, I think, for you to get that information from Whitley Strieber. So you may go to unknowncountry.com if you so choose, unknowncountry.com. John Abramson, our guest this hour. John, this year is not going the way it should be already, I'll tell you. The work that you did in putting together the book Overdosed America, The Broken Promises of American Medicine, what led you to this? Something must have happened. You may have uncovered something. How did you go in that direction?
George, thanks for asking. There are a couple of things that that turned the direction of my career. I was a family doctor, very happy to be a family doc, clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School, a straight doc. I had been a Robert Wood Johnson Fellow before I went into practice in the early 80s and learned research and statistical skills, but really wanted to go take care of people and was a classic family doctor, made house calls and enjoyed seeing kids and old folks and helping people pass on to the next world in peace and comfort. But what happened is during the 1990s, it became clear that there was more and more influence of the drug companies on how we should practice medicine. And I saw an article that was published in August of 2000 in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was about preventing strokes, actually, ironically, by using a cholesterol-lowering drug, Pravacol. And when I looked at that article in the New England Journal, it didn't make any sense. The results weren't statistically significant, and the population was mostly men, and more women have strokes, and the population was too young for people who have strokes. And if you took what happened in that study and applied it to a regular population, the average age is 76 of a stroke, Sharon's age is 77, by the way, and most are women, you'd actually get more strokes, not fewer. So I had never seen such blatant commercialism, and this article was sponsored by the drug company that makes Pravacol. I'd never seen such blatant commercialism, so I went to a research expert at one of the universities in Boston and said, will you look at this with me? Will you tell me if I'm missing anything or if I'm jumping to conclusions or if I'm being too harsh on the company that makes the drug? And the researcher said, no, I think you've got it right. So I said, why don't we write a paper together in one of the academic journals to help to immunize practicing doctors from this growing commercialism so they'll know how to protect their patients? And he looked at me and he said, well, I'd rather not get involved. I do a little research for the drug companies, and I'd rather not get involved in this. And when he said that, George, I realized that the universities, because they had become so dependent on drug company money, were no longer able to perform their real function, which is to oversee the integrity of the knowledge that's produced. So if the universities weren't doing it and the medical journals can't do it anymore, I figured I had to do it. I had to tell this story. So I started to get sensitized to it. The next thing that happened was I found the data about Vioxx on the FDA's website in September of 2001. And this data showed that Vioxx, the drug for arthritis that was withdrawn in September, last September.
Of 2004 or 5?
2004, just a week after the book came out, actually. But in September 2001, I found this data, and it showed clearly that people who took Vioxx developed more heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes than people who took the over-the-counter pain reliever Naproxen, it's sold as Aleve. Mm. And they developed more serious complications overall. And yet Vioxx was being sold as a drug no more effective in terms of preventing relieving arthritis pain, but Vioxx was being sold to doctors as a drug that they should use because it's safer. Not because it's better, more effective, but because it's safer. And here the data that Merck had found from its own study and submitted to the FDA showed that, it wasn't safer. It was significantly more dangerous. And when I saw that and realized that we can no longer trust the New England Journal of Medicine, that the drug companies were really in control of what the best doctors believed to be true, then I realized I needed to tell this story to the American people.
The fact that Sharon was 77 years old and weighed 260 pounds, that had to contribute to this problem.
George is absolutely right, and that's what's wrong with so much of what we do in American medicine, and that's the message that if I can get one message out to you listeners, it's that prevention is so much more important than cure. When you exercise, you reduce your risk of stroke by 7/8. People who don't exercise are 8 times higher risk for having a stroke than people who do exercise. People who smoke are at 6 times higher risk of stroke than people who don't smoke. People who have untreated blood pressure are at 4 times higher risk. So we don't have great therapies once people have strokes. The benefit of our therapies are exaggerated, and I'd love to talk about that, but the benefits are exaggerated. What is missing from our medical care is if you're worried about having a stroke, then start exercising, quit smoking, and make sure your blood pressure is controlled. And that will prevent most strokes.
Let's take some phone calls for you, Dr. John Abramson.
Yeah.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello. There he is. I hear someone.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
This is Joe from Omaha.
Okay, Joe, take it away.
I appreciate it. With this being the Congress saying that this is the decade of pain research, what does Dr. John have to say about the research that they're doing, and what new breakthroughs on this pain research have come out of this?
Okay, and I'll let you listen on your radio, Joe. Go ahead,
Joe. Joe, great question. Pain is a really important issue in medicine, and for a long time, pain has been undertreated. And when I went through medical school and during the early part of my career, we undertreated pain because we were always taught to look for people who were abusing drugs and who were trying to take advantage of us. And then there was kind of a breakthrough that we didn't have to let people suffer. We ought not to let people suffer. So especially for people who were terminally ill and for people who had chronic conditions with unrelenting pain, that we needed to treat them well. Now, the pendulum has swung a little bit, or had swung a little bit too far towards using narcotics for things like arthritis of the knee. And what we saw was that the drug companies that are making money on expensive new drugs for pain were pushing this information. So, for example, one of our most prestigious hospitals in Boston made a contract with the company that makes OxyContin to use to teach that we should be using this long-acting form of pain relief instead of much less expensive short-acting pain relievers that are made of exactly the same drug. So when we get into a debate like this, Joe, there's always two sides to it. One side is we must treat pain and treat it aggressively. We cannot let people suffer needlessly. The other side is we've got to be careful who's giving us the message, because if it's the company that's making the pain medicine and they're making tons of money because doctors are being convinced to use more of their expensive drugs, not inexpensive drugs, then we've got to be careful that we're getting pushed to use too much medicine.
What was the reaction to Overdosed America, your book, John?
George, before it came out, my colleagues thought I had a loose screw. They thought I was really nuts saying that we can't trust the journals. It's like saying you can't trust your minister or priest or rabbi. And a week after the book came out, Vioxx was withdrawn from the market, and suddenly people started to say, holy cow, this guy's been cloistered away for 3 years doing research, unraveling what we think we know about medicine, and there are some very important points here. So now I go all over the country giving grand rounds, speaking to doctors and medical students, and when you look at the data, when you put the data up on the screen, the way doctors and students are taught to look at scientific evidence, it's just incontrovertible. The real message here is that the scientific evidence that doctors have been trained to trust has been mostly taken over by the drug companies. So 3/4 of the studies that are published in our best journals are commercially sponsored. The odds are 5 times greater that commercially sponsored studies will find that their drugs are the treatment of choice compared to studies that are not commercially sponsored and look at the same drugs. So the real scientific evidence shows that the scientific evidence that doctors believe to be true is more like an infomercial than dispassionate science. And now doctors are just starting to get it. Doctors are just starting to have the courage to say, gee, maybe what the articles in those journals are biased because they're funded by the drug companies and their mission is to sell more drugs. Maybe the expert panels that are giving us the recommendations for treatment of lowering cholesterol or treating arthritis, maybe the fact that the majority of the experts on those panels are getting paid by drug companies who have drugs that are being considered, just maybe that is clouding their vision, their unbiased vision. So docs are just starting to get it, that they are victims of bad information, the same way that the public is victims of this over-marketing that's overdosing America. George, the bottom line is that out of the 22 wealthiest industrialized countries, Americans live the shortest amount of time in good health of any of those 22 countries, and yet we're spending twice as much money on health care, twice as much. So if you look at what goes on in our health care system, it looks like a third of the money and the procedures, the money that we spend on health care, a third is either unnecessary or harmful. And when you add that up, that's $600 billion a year, billion with a B, more than the Defense Department is spending, including Iraq. We're wasting $600 billion a year on health care that's either unnecessary or harmful. And what we're doing is avoiding the kinds of things that probably would have prevented Ariel Sharon's stroke, which is to get this obese guy to start taking care of himself, to exercise, to decrease the stress in his life a bit, to lose some weight, would have been the best medicine possible. And we need to start giving up the fantasies that medical science will rescue us from disasters after we don't take care of ourselves.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with Dr. John Abramson on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, this is Donald from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Hi, Donald.
Yes, my question is, how do you feel about Kevin Trudeau's book, Natural Cures, They Don't Want You to Know About? I've just read a lot of mixed reviews, or some say he's like a con artist. I just want to know your ideas about his book.
Yeah, Tom, that's a great question. And my own personal opinion is that we've got a double-edged sword. On the one hand, Kevin Trudeau is making a tremendous contribution because it is true there are cures that people don't want us to know about. For example, if you're interested in preventing heart disease, we're all trained, doctors and patients, to look at your cholesterol. What we ought to be looking at is whether you're exercising, whether you're eating a Mediterranean-style diet, not smoking, controlling the stress in your life. That's the way to prevent heart disease. It's going to prevent a whole lot more heart disease than getting your cholesterol checked. I'm not against getting your cholesterol checked, but they don't want us to know that there are really effective preventions that won't generate any profits for the drug companies. So to that extent, I think that Kevin Trudeau has done a great service. Now, at heart, I'm a scientist, and I don't think that it's fair to overread the data in the other direction and start saying that these cures are miracle cures that are going to be better than drugs when in fact the science isn't very good in that direction either. So I think what I want to do with my message to the public is to try and bring the real scientific evidence, not my own prejudice, not what I hope to be true, but to bring the real scientific evidence, which is that 70% of our health is in our own hands, that it has to do with the lifestyle decisions we make and the environment we live in. And what if Americans want to have better health, what each of us needs to do individually and for our families is to take responsibility for our own health, to do the things that we know are healthy. I don't think there's magic out there in terms of good health and finding the right herb and so forth. Some herbs are very helpful, but not all. So I think what we really need to do is accept responsibility for our own health care and then have a relationship with a doctor who understands us, who understands who we are as an individual person, who can then guide us into the best of medical care with caution and humility so that we don't get overdosed.
How would you rate America's medicine and practice compared to other parts of the world?
What we're seeing, George, is that if you have an illness that is for which the best treatment is the most lucrative treatment, the United States is the place to be. But for most people, most of the time, that's not the case. And our healthcare system is inferior for most people most of the time. In fact, I just saw some shocking data. One of the best snapshots about the health of a population is how many years of life are lost below the age of 75. Because below age 75, for the most part, people who die don't die of old age. And so we look at that and we compare that internationally. And for the last 100 years, that the number of years of life lost below age 75 has been going down. Since 1960, it's been going down faster in the other industrialized countries than in the United States, but certainly getting better in the United States. Between 2000 and 2005, it actually got worse. So Americans lost more years of life below the age of 75 in 2005 than they did in 2000. So what we've got is this weird healthcare system where if you have a disease that you can, that there's a very expensive solution for, you should be here. But because our healthcare system is mostly driven by profits, seeking of profits, what you get is healthcare that generates the most profits, and it doesn't include the kinds of preventive measures that are really going to lead us all to be healthier.
All right, we've got time for one quick call. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, John Amberson. I just got to ask you real quick. If they say that more than 50% of the people had normal cholesterol levels, had an MI, well, what happens if you bring your cholesterol level down to below normal level? Does that mean you're at a risk factor now?
That's a good question. What happens is that when you bring your cholesterol down below normal, many people will have less heart disease. But this is an example of what I was talking about before. The drug companies are bringing us these studies. So you have less heart disease. But if you look at the overall effect on healthy people, you see that you don't have less death and you don't have a decrease in overall serious illnesses. So for people who don't already have heart disease, bringing your cholesterol down below normal may decrease your risk of heart disease, but is unlikely to improve your overall chance of staying healthy. On the other hand, if you're not exercising, if you're not eating a Mediterranean-style diet, if you just do those two things, it's going to cut your risk of heart disease much more, and your risk of cancer, and your risk of stroke and depression and many other illnesses.
All right, John Abramson, thank you so much. You will, of course, always be one of our sources. Thanks, John.
George, pleasure to be with you, and my condolences to Art and his family.
Thank you so much. In a moment, Glynis McCants, the numbers lady. Glynis, of course, is one of our favorites. Under the circumstances of tonight, we will talk about some more serious subjects with Glynis McCants. We'll be back in a moment.